What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, please consider us as a great venue to get that question of yours answered. Well, we're not going to be taking your live calls today. We're instead doing one of our famous, patent-pending, mailbag programs, wherein we answer a whole bunch of questions that we've received via email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, the address for that is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We'll answer some short emails. We'll answer some longer emails. We'll get a whole bunch of business done in the next 55 minutes or so. Along with our producer, Charles Beery, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you?
Great. Are you ready to plunge in?
Let's plunge.
Here is one from Michelle. This is actually very timely. She says, the prayer for the first day of the Divine Mercy Novena suggests that God plunges into bitter grief over lost souls. I understand that God is love, but what is meant by this statement? Is God's grief like our grief? Thank you, Michelle.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So anytime we ascribe human emotion to God, we are speaking analogously, right? So, and for that matter, anytime we predicate of God at all, anytime you open your mouth and say anything about God, the closest you can come to capturing God in his essence is by way of analogy. And we can only draw analogies from things of which we have experience,
sure,
like human emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no perfect correspondence between the inner life of God and the inner life of man. There is at best an analogy. Now, from a strictly philosophical point of view, the Catholic Church has always taught that God doesn't have emotions, and not as we understand the term, to be sure. And it's fairly easy to see why. I mean, we experience emotion very much as a sensible phenomenon. That is, i.e., something that you can sense, the way you can taste things, you can smell things, you can have emotional reactivity to things. And our emotionality involves change. Right, so passing from one state to another, and it involves our biology as well. I mean, this is effectively a function of the neurotransmitters in our brain and various hormones and things of that sort, none of which is applicable to God. And in particular, God, not only does he not have a biology, but he has absolutely no capacity to change whatsoever at all. God is eternally the same and has no passing state. So God doesn't move from grief to sadness to happiness to joy to hilarity to boredom, you know, to creativity, to lassitude. I mean, nothing like that is in God. He just eternally is his own beatitude and his own divine essence. And so the language of emotion is inappropriately applied to him if we're using it in a strictly philosophical sense. However, sacred scripture predicates emotion of God all the time. So how do we understand that as Catholics, trying to get to the philosophical root of it? And here's one way to look at it. If you are alienated from God through your own sin, the loss of his favorable countenance, you will experience as wrath. But it doesn't mean you should think of God as sort of having his temper flared up,
yeah,
if you see what I'm saying.
I do.
And you can do the same with other emotional states that that you would encounter in the course of your relationship with him.
Okay. And we do appreciate your email. Here's one now from Paul in Pennsylvania. Rather famous question here. Why do we have to go to a priest for confession?
Right. So just to clarify, the Catholic Church teaches that it is not optional. It is, in fact, mandatory that you confess your sins directly to God. I didn't say exclusively, but directly.
Right.
Right. So every Catholic, Lord tells us in the Lord's Prayer, you know, we have to pray like this, Father, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. On a daily basis, Christians are to pray directly to God, their Father, asking for the forgiveness of sins and all our other kinds of temporal and eternal benefits. And we don't go through the mediation immediately of members of the Catholic clergy to do that. But in addition to our life of private prayer, there is a public act, or I should say, not a public act, but an objective act in the presence of witnesses.
Okay.
And the reason why is that when Christ rose from the dead, the very first thing he said to the apostles when he saw them, it wasn't like, how's the weather been for the last 72 hours? It was, receive the Holy Spirit, whose sins you forgive are forgiven, whose sins you retain are retained. He gave the church the power to forgive sins. Now, why would Jesus do this if he did not intend for the church to make use of the power? And the same question you ask about the sacrament of reconciliation, you could ask about all of the sacraments. Why give us sacraments? Why institute rituals as means of grace, since God could just as easily distribute that grace without intermediary directly to the human soul, right? And there are a couple of reasons. So basically, the long and the short of it is that the sacraments are conformed to our particular cognitive machinery, the way our minds, our psychology work, that we tend to have need of tangible signs and evidences. I mean, I can remember being a Protestant kid and going to the prayer chapel at my university and praying for God's forgiveness. How much I would have benefited if I had had a word of assurance where, you know, God had sort of whispered from heaven and said, it's cool, Andrews, I've got this. You know, that would have been encouraging. And it would have made a difference in the way I conducted my spiritual life. And the best that the Protestant ministry could do for me was to say, well, you know, we can tell you in general terms that God forgives the sins of penitent, contrite sinners. And so that leaves me in the quandary of going, well, do I meet that qualification?
Yeah.
Am I sufficiently contrite? Am I sufficiently penitent? And, you know, do I really have faith in Jesus? It kind of leaves you in that that sense of either presumption or despair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I became Catholic, I realized that sense of, you know, I'd like that encouraging word with divine authority to say, hey, trust, your prayer has been answered. You are, in fact, forgiven. And I got that in the form of the confessional. Right. In the same way, like, I want to know that I'm regenerated, that I'm born again, that I have the Spirit of God living within me, that I've been joined to Christ. If I'm left without a sacrament of baptism, then it's like, well, you know, am I really born again? Have I really been joined to Christ? Is my faith sincere? Have I met the qualifications? By attaching grace to a tangible sign like baptism,
mm-hmm.
there's no question. I'm like, am I a Christian? Oh, yeah, I was baptized. So there's a psychological benefit. There are other reasons to have the Sacrament of Reconciliation as well that I can, you know, get to after the break or some other time.
Paul, we really, really do appreciate your email. Thanks for sending it to us, and I'm glad we could answer your question. In a moment, we'll get one from Peter in Minnesota and lots more on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Stay with us. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Andrews here on this Friday afternoon on EWTN Radio. If you're just joining us, we're doing a special mailbag account of our program today, so we're not going to be taking any live calls. So do enjoy these emails because, you know, this happens all the time. We'll read an email or we'll take a call, and then somebody will say, wow, that was my question. So you never know, your question might get answered on this mailbag program, even if you didn't send us an email. Here is one now from Peter in Minnesota, and this will take you to your former happy place, David. Dr. Andrews, in confessional Presbyterianism, a strict adherence to Westminster Larger Catechism questions number 100 through number 148, which is the Ten Commandments, is a prescription for religious scrupulosity. In this framework, as you know, every sin is mortal in its consequences and is a great setup for their doctrine of penal substitutionary atonement. So here are my questions for you. There are three questions. Number one, how would you contrast a Catholic understanding of the Ten Commandments? Number two, how would you instruct an ex-Presbyterian to understand when a matter is grave? And number three, how would you respond to a Protestant piously claiming that they have a higher view of God's law and His holiness than the false church that is the Catholic Church? Thanks for your answers, Peter in Minnesota.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So obviously, when it comes to contrasting the Ten Commandments in Reformed and Catholic theology, the first and most obvious note is the way we number them is different. And as you know, the Reformed tradition takes the first commandment and breaks it into two, so that thou shalt have no graven images is its own commandment, and the last commandment Well, the last two commandments are collapsed into one. So coveting your neighbor's golf clubs and his hamster fall into the same category for the Reformed as coveting his wife, whereas Catholics tend to think that hamsters and wives are different categories when you're coveting. So that's an obvious difference. But that's not the sense of your question. You want to know, Calvin taught that the Ten Commandments are a metonymy, where, you know, you have the part standing for the whole, and so within, say, the command against adultery is included, the prohibition against any kind of sexual sin. Now, the Catholic Church also views the Ten Commandments that way. They're a metonymy, and they don't, you know, they're not limited to the literal text of the commandment, but they have a more expansive application. The difference is that for the Reformed theologian, and you've already alluded to this in your question, if you violate, you know, anything, any of those sort of inferential sins down the line, that you're guilty of the whole kit and caboodle, that you have the full weight of mortal sin standing against you. If you, if I don't tell my great aunt what I really think about her new hat, then I'm fully guilty for the sin of perjury or bearing false witness, in the same way if I, you know, bore false witness in a capital murder trial or something. Yeah. They don't distinguish between sin doesn't differ from sin in gravity in the Reformed system. So that's the big difference in terms of application. Now, how would I counsel a formerly Reformed person in making a judgment about the question of the gravity of sin? Okay, so here's where this is a critical point, and it's going to go to your third question as well. So woven into your head as a Reformed Protestant, or a Lutheran Protestant too, sometimes for that matter, is the idea that you lowly worm of a man are not in a position to call into question the justice of God's judgment. And so if God, as you understand them, has decreed X, well, you just have to swallow X no matter how irrational it might seem. Mm. And so, you know, if God calls for the genocide of Canaanites, well, then we'd have to conclude that the genocide of Canaanites is just a good thing. You know, if God says that I'm going to elect a small minority of the human race to salvation, and they will be irresistibly called to that salvation, so in spite of their own will, I'm going to save them just through my own benevolence, and then the vast majority of the human race I'm going to condemn to an eternal torment before, you know, any conception of their foreseen merit, so without any regard of their, the question of sort of antecedent determination based on foreseen merit. So I'm just going to arbitrarily decide this group of people is not going to get grace. They're going to be born in mortal sin or original sin, and they're just going to go to hell, and there's nothing they can do about it, and Christ doesn't even make atonement for them. That you cannot, is wrong for you as a Reformed Protestant to say that's not fair. Who are you, O man, to talk back to God? So that sense that God's moral demands and God's moral law just vastly outstrips the capacity of human reason. So human reason is just not a category that can be applied. That doesn't hold in Catholicism. On the contrary, we think that the moral law written into the human conscience and the human heart is also divine revelation, and that we have a moral obligation to bring faith and reason into alignment, and that includes in the moral sphere. And so there are places in Catholic exegesis, for example, where passages in the Old Testament where God seems to be acting in an arbitrary manner, where Catholic theologians and fathers of the church and doctors of the church will conclude, well, you know, that if we take that literally, it seems to implicate God in injustice. That means we can't take that text literally. We have to take that in another sense, one that doesn't make God out to be a tyrant, that the standards of justice that are intuitive, you know, the principles of sort of fair play and equity that are common to the human race, like that applies in moral reasoning, right? So when it comes to the question of adjudicating mortal sin, there is a kind of intuition that you have based on your experience of fair play and equity and empathy that can inform your realization. So if something is a profound violation of human dignity, and in a way that you yourself would experience as a profound violation of human dignity, that's a pretty good signal that that's a mortal sin, right? So, you know, if your nephew comes over and steals a Snickers bar out of your refrigerator, the likelihood that you're going to feel like that was a profound violation of your dignity is very low. If your nephew comes over and takes your gun out of your gun cabinet and shoots your youngest child, that you're going to feel to be a very grave violation of human dignity. Now, on the Reformed system, your intuitions about what counts as grave don't matter.
Wow.
They don't matter. And so the candy bar is just as worthy of eternal torment within a Reformed scheme as the murder, right? And the Catholic Church doesn't view it that way, doesn't see it that way. Those intuitions based on, you know, what would I have wanted to have been done to me, that principle of the golden rule, that can apply in those kind of moral judgments. Now, the Church doesn't give you a hard and fast line and say everything on this side of the line is a mortal sin and everything on that side of the line is a venial sin, because some of the criteria determining mortal and venial are subjective, meaning that the position of the person committing the sin affects the gravity of the sin. And illustration I've used in the past is, you know, consider the sin of missing Mass and how we would evaluate it differently, say, if a priest who had, you know, he had that Mass for the day. His job was to say Mass at 10 a.m. on Sunday, and he skips off and plays golf. That is an objectively more grave sin than, you know, some 13-year-old kid who plays hooky because he, you know, he's just got his new video game or something. It's not good. We're not approving that kid, but it's just not the same category as the priest who has that obligation.
Sure.
All right. So you can draw those kinds of distinctions. And that's why you don't say, well, every time somebody misses Mass, you necessarily say it's a mortal sin, because not everybody's in the same subjective position. And your degree of knowledge, your degree of awareness, your degree of freedom of action, of course, the Reformed Church denies that we have free will, but the extent to which your actions are free and not compelled, all those things play into the mortal venial distinction. So the rule of thumb that I like to follow is, unless you, you know, are suffering from grave scrupulosity, you know, if you don't think it's mortal, it probably isn't, but when in doubt, go to confession.
Sure.
Because you can confess venial sins, right? And then you have objective certainty that whatever your sin, you're absolved. Priest says, I absolve you, you're absolved. And you put it behind you, you don't have to worry about it ever again. And then the final question was about, do I think the Reformed have a higher view of God's law? Personally, I think they have a ridiculously low view of God's law.
Huh.
I think they set up God's law for mockery and derision because it depicts God as an irrational tyrant, right? I mean, high in the sense that of high and mighty. You know, like, I mean, Saddam Hussein, when he was in power in Iraq, I mean, his word was law. And if you didn't do what he said, he could, you know, literally throw you to the lions. I've heard testimony that he actually kept wild animals in his palace and used to feed people to them for fun and entertainment, you know.
Ugh.
I mean, all kinds of horrific things would happen to you. And so high in the sense of being imperious and authoritative and tyrannical, and you're quaking in your boots at the thought of disobeying him, but not high in the sense of being just, not high in the sense of being noble, not high in the sense of being imitable, not high in the sense of being inspirational, not high in the sense of elevating your concept of God in love, to understanding God to be the genuine repository of everything that human reason can grasp to be good, true, and beautiful. In that sense, no, quite the opposite of high, but base, low, arbitrary, tyrannical, and worthy of derision.
Peter in Minnesota, thanks so much for your email. Dr. Anders unpacked a wealth of information there. You'll probably want to check out the website for, you know, go over it, listen to it, rewind it, listen to it again. And here's how to get there, ewtn.com/radio. Once you're on the radio homepage, look for the words Podcast Central, and you'll see that at the top right corner of your screen. And then click on that, scroll down to Call to Communion, and you're off to the races. We're doing a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN on this Friday afternoon. Here's a rather timely question from Dennis. Hey, Dr. Anders, why do we call it Easter Sunday? Wasn't that the name of some pagan goddess? Thanks. Happy Easter, Dennis.
Yeah, thanks. So, of course, we only do that in English. So that's not the Latin word for Easter. It's not any of the Romance languages' words for Easter. I don't know how we say Easter in every language on the planet. But for most of them, the word is derived from the Aramaic that has to do with the Paschal sacrifice. It has to do with the Hebrew and Aramaic word for Passover.
Uh-huh.
Like Pach is the French word. What is it? Pascua in Spanish, or I don't speak Spanish, but something like that. So it has nothing to do etymologically with the word Easter. Easter is just the unique English word, which, of course, is not the normative Catholic usage. And the one explanation we have for this in history comes from the Venerable Bede. He's a pre-modern English, you know, Saxon theologian from the British Isles, who says that it came from the name of the month in which the celebration was, in which the feast was celebrated. So, in the same way that, you know, we have, We have in our modern calendar, we have January, we have Mars.
Uh-huh.
We have these holidays, these months that are named after Roman deities. It doesn't mean that if I have a party in Mars or I'm in March, or if I have, you know, some event in January to mark the turn of the year, that I'm implicated in worshiping, you know, the Roman god Janus or the Roman god Mars. It's just the name of the month. It just, it's
sure.
a holdover from our Greco-Roman past. Beach says that's what happened with the Feast of Easter. It took
okay.
its name from the month, and the month was in fact named after a pagan goddess. But it doesn't implicate the Christians in worship of that goddess any more than we're implicated in the worship of Janus if we happen to say that the month is January.
Yeah. Dennis, thanks so much for your email. Scott in Houston sent us this one. Dr. Anders, I read in a book where the author describes theological hope as, quote, sure and certain hope. I always thought that if you believe something without proof, that is the definition of faith, not hope. What am I missing here?
Okay, so hope is really faith oriented toward the future, right? So let me put this in very contemporary terms. I have faith that my wife is trustworthy, right? I if she tells me something, I'm going to believe that that's the case.
Sure.
Because I know that she is not intending to deceive me. She is intrinsically trustworthy, and I have grounds for believing her to be trustworthy. Because my wife is trustworthy, if she says, and I'm going to show up at the network at 2:30 after your show, and we'll go take a walk, you know, we'll go to the botanical gardens and make an afternoon of it, that I can legitimately look forward to that because she's trustworthy. I know that she will keep her word unless some extraordinary thing happens. And she'll be here. Well, she's not actually coming today because it's raining in Alabama as we make this recording.
Yes.
But, hypothetically. And so it's faith oriented towards the future.
Okay.
And so it's certain, like faith, insofar it's based on the credibility of God and his testimony. But it's hope as opposed to faith because it's oriented towards the future and not towards some sort of propositional truth.
Very good. Scott in Houston, thanks so much for your email. Here's one now from Joe in Pennsylvania. He says, in relation to original sin, is God holding a grudge?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. So the Catholic doctrine of original sin is that original sin is not actual sin. It's sin only by analogy, and it's not anything positively inhering in the soul, and so it doesn't elicit from God wrath, right? God is not hateful towards humans that are born in original sin. Quite the contrary, original sin simply means the absence of sanctifying grace, which grace God desires to give to all people. Now, if He held a grudge against me, why would He want to turn around and grant me eternal life?
Yeah. Good point. Appreciate that. And thank you, Joe in Pennsylvania. This one will take us to the break from Krista. Dr. Anders, I've always heard that Jesus was on the cross for 3 hours, but according to the Gospel of Mark, he was crucified at 9 a.m. and died at 3 p.m. Can you please help me understand this? Thanks for all you do in your ministry.
Yeah, I didn't know it was three. I thought it was six.
Six.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
But she says that Jesus was on the cross for 3 hours.
Well, then she said the Gospel of Mark says from 9 to 3 in the afternoon.
Three.
That's 6 hours.
So, okay. Okay. I think she's saying that elsewhere in sacred scripture here,
right,
that Jesus was on the cross for 3 hours, but it's actually six.
Right. So let's deal with a general question, which is that of harmonizing the Gospels.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And there are people who take the view that if two Gospels give a conflicting account of something in the life of Jesus, that there has to be a way to reconcile those accounts, and there's no way that they have to both be true at some level. And there are harmonies of the Gospels throughout the centuries that have sought to do that, but you can also recognize that the Gospel writers make some creative use of their source material because they have underlying theological agenda. So you have to read the numerology within the text in light of what that particular author is trying to communicate.
Krista, thanks so much for your email. We'll get to lots more on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. No calls today. We're taking a special mailbag edition of our program here on EWTN. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, here is the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. by the time we empty out the mailbag at the end of today's show, I believe it will start to fill up again. So your email will have some very good company. Here's an interesting question from Diego. Hello, Dr. Anders. Is it possible for God to command us to do what is evil? In the Summa Theologica, question 94, article 5, St. Thomas considers whether or not the natural law is changeable. In his response to objection 2, it seems that he suggests whatever God commands us to do cannot be morally wrong, even if he were to command us to, say, for instance, commit adultery. It does not seem plausible to me that God could command evil at all. What do you have to say about this? Thanks, Diego.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, in the late Middle Ages, there was a major philosophical debate in the Catholic tradition about the status of universals, whether or not universal concepts like triangularity or green or goodness, right? You take it, something that could be applied to any number of particulars, whether those universal concepts had some sort of real ontological existence, a la Platonism, or whether the only thing that really exists are singulars, right? And so this is the debate between the realists and the nominalists. But what prompted the underlying debate was a concern about divine freedom. So, you know, there was a strong desire to preserve the doctrine of divine and human freedom over against the necessitarianism, the determinism of Arabic Averroistic theology, right? Averroes was a, or Averroes, was an Arabian theologian, an Andalusian theologian, who took a very deterministic line and said that, you know, God has to do. And the Catholic theologians wanted to say, no, God is really free. He's not compelled by something outside of his own nature. And so, because it had a theological motive, but it ended up in a philosophical dispute, because if things like goodness have a kind of intrinsic ontological necessity, then from one point of view, they would seem to compel the hand of God, that God is somehow obligated ontologically to a particular conception of goodness. And there were some philosophers, theologians, in particular William of Ockham, who wanted to affirm divine freedom so much that he denied the existence of universals. He said there aren't things like goodness or greenness or canine nature, anything like that. There's no sort of general category that has real ontological existence, because if there is such, then God is not radically, radically free. And so, playing with thought experiments, Ockham would ask questions like, could the Son of God have become incarnate in a donkey as opposed to a human being? Could God command adultery? Could God command murder? And of course, he wanted to take the position that yes, God could do such things. And that nominalist sort of radical libertarian view of divine freedom came to characterize the Reformation polemic, particularly when it came to the doctrine of predestination. So, you know, Luther, for example, who was a predestinarian and thought that God arbitrarily stipulated that the majority of the human race would go to hell just to serve his ends, to God's ends, recognized that it would seem to implicate God in injustice, and he gave a very Occamist nominalist answer, which is that, hey, God's will is the rule of justice. There's nothing outside of the divine will that can define that. Mm-hmm. Calvin took a very similar line. And one consequence of that is if you hold that view, if you hold the voluntarist view on morality, it leads inevitably to something called divine command ethics, namely that the only way you can know the moral good is for God to tell you, because there just is no other category other than the divine will. And so one day God could command adultery, and the other day he could forbid adultery, and just in virtue of God having commanded it, a thing is said to be good or bad. And that's just what it means for something to be good. It just means that God has arbitrarily stipulated it, and tomorrow he could stipulate something else. There are some Muslim philosophers that take that line very, very, very hard. So Al-Ghazali, for example, took that line so much so that he thought that even not the natural law morally, but even sort of the laws of nature as such were utterly arbitrary, that God, you know, could command the stars to fall, or he could make 2 + 2 equal something other than 4, And famously, he said, you know, fire doesn't burn the cotton ball, but God burns the cotton ball in the presence of the fire, a position called occasionalism, the idea that there are no natural causes at all. Everything is radically dependent on the will of God. And Calvin actually took that position as well. He once said in his commentary on Ezekiel that that food doesn't nourish us, but God nourishes us on the occasion of food being in our stomachs. For much the same reason that Al-Ghazali took it. He didn't want there to be anything outside the will of God that can condition the will of God. Now, there have been Catholic theologians like Ockham, who's not exactly a hero in the Catholic tradition, but there have been Catholic theologians like Ockham, to a lesser extent Scotus, that tilted in that direction of sort of divine voluntarism, libertarian freedom, and a kind of divine command view of ethics. But the majority position in the Catholic tradition has not gone that way, including St. Thomas. And it has been that goodness is a natural property of things, that philosophical universals do exist. Numbers are real. Concepts like goodness and truth and beauty are real. They do have real ontological purchase. And that human reason can discern moral goods independent of special revelation, that I can know a thing to be good because I can have a rational understanding of something's nature, and I can understand what tends to its flourishing. So, for example, if I understand what it is to be a human being, I can grasp rationally that the good of a human being is his or her rationality. And so something that tends to defeat or diminish human rationality is in itself bad for a human in that sense, qua human, right? That's been the majority Catholic view down through the centuries, so much so that some of the church fathers, and I'm thinking here about Gregory of Nyssa in particular, would take the position that when divine revelation seems to implicate God in something that human intuition would understand to be unjust, that when divine revelation seems to implicate God in injustice, then we are obligated morally to dispute the literal sense of divine revelation. That's when you have to bring in allegory to understand the Old Testament, for example. You run into, the passages that seem that God is commanding the genocide of the Canaanites. And some of the church fathers took the line that, well, since that makes God out to be a tyrant, we obviously can't take these texts literally. So that's how strongly they would emphasize the role that human reason can play in understanding the divine nature and the moral law and our own moral obligations.
Fascinating. Diego, thanks so much for your email. It's called a communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Question now from Jared. He says, hi, gents. A couple of things popped into my mind recently after going for the masses during Holy Week. Is there any particular typographical or other significant reason why Judas chose to identify Jesus with a kiss rather than just by pointing and saying, yeah, that's him? Also, are there any other reasons why we believe Jesus rose from the dead after 3 days other than because he said he would? Because they only discovered the empty tomb on Sunday. My best, Jared.
Yeah, thanks. So, that's a good question about the kiss. Now, the kiss is a less dramatic gesture in the ancient Near East than it is today. You know, like if I betrayed Tom Price with a kiss, that would be weird on more than one account.
Yes.
You know, because I'm not in the habit of kissing Tom Price.
Thank you.
But I also don't live in the ancient Near East.
True.
In which case, if I did, we might start every show with a kiss of peace, which is common in some parts of the world. So
yes,
it's not quite as freaky weird as it sounds,
okay,
right?
All right.
From a narrative point of view, from a strictly narrative point of view, the irony is highlighted because he betrays Christ with the gesture of a friend. And of course, that is integral to the nature of Christ's suffering, that he's abandoned by his friends and those that are closer to him. Now, I'm sure the church fathers they're always rather long-winded in drawing out allegorical and typological significance for gospel events. And I'm sure they'll think of many more that haven't occurred to me. And I just don't have a commentary at hand that lists, everything that every Catholic commentator has said. But that's what occurs to me off the top of my head. Now, in terms of, why on the third day? That's a really good question. It's significant that Christ dies on Passover, obviously. And he dies on the eve of the Sabbath, and that is very significant. That is very significant because in the Old Testament book of Genesis and throughout the Mosaic Law, the Sabbath is a celebration of the completion of God's creative act. It's you rest on the seventh day as God rested on the seventh day after he did everything, said it's good. And the Christian claim from the beginning was that the coming of Christ, it's not just the arrival of the long-awaited Jewish Messiah, although it is that. It's the reconstitution of the cosmos, that Jesus doesn't just save Israel from her enemies. He saves the human race from cosmic disaster, and reality gets rewritten in the person of Jesus. And so the symbolism of Christ rising on the eighth day, the first day of the week, is significant, that the old order, including the Sabbatarian worship, well, not worship, but the Sabbatarian celebration of the Hebrew people and temple worship and all the rest of it, is done away with. A few minutes ago, we were talking about the Gospel of Mark and his account of the death of Jesus, and you'll note that Mark recounts darkness falling over the land for 3 whole hours at the time of Christ's crucifixion. Jesus' ministry in the Gospel of Mark is portrayed as a confrontation, not with flesh and blood, but with demonic forces that have their hand in the world system, you know, kind of apocalyptic view of contemporary Judean history. And all of that sort of comes to a head when the devil and his hordes do their worst, as it were, right there at the moment of the cross. And then Jesus' resurrection is the total reversal of that whole power system. And so the church celebrates the first day of the week, the Lord's Day, the day of his resurrection, as the beginning of a whole new universe.
Yay. Amen. Jared, thanks so much for your email today. It is a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. A little bit later on most of these EWTN stations, be sure to join us for Beacon of Truth with Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. That'll be at 4 p.m. Eastern today. Deacon Harold welcomes Immaculee Ilibagiza to talk about forgiveness and Our Lady of Kibeho. If you're not familiar with her story, wow, it is fantastic. Also, Deacon dives into Psalms 73 as his want to do. He likes to tackle one of the Psalms in each of his programs. Again, Beacon of Truth with Deacon Harold Burke Sivers today at 4 p.m. Eastern on most of these EWTN stations. Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews in progress today. Here's one from Matt in Boston. Hey, Dr. Andrews, a very common phrase I often hear Protestant pastors cite is 2 Corinthians 5:8. Usually they paraphrase the verse and they say, quote, "To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord," as a means to refute the existence of purgatory or the idea of soul sleep, etc. In the actual verse, according to the RSV, it reads, "We are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord." However, the Protestant pastor in question will sometimes read the actual verse from the New King James Version, which reads, quote, "We are confident, yes, well, rather pleased, to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord." St. Paul is saying, quote, "We would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord," which is altogether different from saying, "To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord." So, Dr. Andrews, could you please comment generally on this topic? How would you respond to a Protestant who uses this verse as a denial of the existence of purgatory and that his understanding of the verse is problematic? Thanks and God bless, Matt in Boston.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the question of the interpretation of 2 Corinthians 5 is a convoluted and controversial one, to say the least. I think at the very least what we can say about this text is it indicates that St. Paul has a lively confidence that he will be present with the Lord when absent from the body. And I don't know that there's anything in the text that suggests you can automatically extrapolate to the position of every individual believing Christian. Now, when Paul does address the question of the status of sort of Christians in general, the question of the intermediate state, what happens to the soul immediately upon death, is sort of left in abeyance. He doesn't really address it head on. And so take, for example, his treatment of the question in 1 Thessalonians. The issue there was the Thessalonians were so they had such high expectation for the imminent return of Christ, when they knew they would receive the reward of the resurrection of their bodies, that or the glorification of their bodies, that when a Christian in Thessalonica died, they thought, well, he's missed out. That's it. His chance of eternity is over because he wasn't here at the return of the Lord. That's how imminent they thought the return of the Lord was going to be. And this was a perfect opportunity for Paul to have said, hey, chill out, guys. Don't you know they're already in heaven with the Lord? And yet, that's not what he says. What he says is, be confident that we're not going to precede those that have already died. He doesn't say they've preceded us. Mm. He says, we're not going to precede those who have already died. But when the Lord comes back, they'll be raised and will be changed and we'll all be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. That's fascinating because he doesn't go where you think he ought to go, which is to say they're already in heaven. Now, this kind of ambiguity is why there were divergent positions in Christian antiquity on the fate of the soul immediately after death. So the soul sleep position was never dominant, but it was one that got floated. And it wasn't actually until the pontificate of Benedict XII, Pope Benedict XII, who is a 15th century character, that you have the dogma of the beatific vision available to the saints immediately upon death defined. Mm. And so there's actually a pope, John the 22nd, who taught, but in a non-official capacity, a grave theological error. Yes, you can have popes that have erroneous theological opinions. John the 22nd was one of them. And he held to a version of the doctrine of soul sleep personally, against the common opinion of the Catholic faithful and against the teaching of most of the theologians and the consensus of the saints. That's why he was sort of roundly rebuked by Catholic notables of the day for holding that point of view. But he actually held that point of view, and it was after his death. He recanted it by the end of his life, and the next pope said, you know, we got to clear up this beatific vision thing right away. You know, so he issues an encyclical, a bull, papal bull, actually, Benedictus Deus, defining the dogma of the beatific vision, namely that the saints who die in the grace of God with, you know, without attachment to sin can experience the beatific vision immediately upon death. But there was ambiguity there in the tradition. So what tilted the interpretive framework about 2 Corinthians 5 more in this direction of, well, this is something that's applicable to all of Christians and not just St. Paul. It's not just Paul's expectation that he'll get that, but other patients could also potentially go immediately to heaven after they die. Well, interestingly, I think you have to look at the Catholic devotional tradition of prayer to the saints, right? And the picture of the afterlife given in the book of Revelation, that there are saints under the altar who have been martyred and are waiting, you know, hopefully for the resurrection of the dead. And the lively Catholic practice of praying to the saints sort of implies that they are around to hear them. You know, they're not like knocked out of sleep. But again, that's not something that the expectation is for every single Christian, but just those who have ended their lives in martyrdom or extraordinary holiness, you know, as Paul himself clearly did. So there's just no normative teaching in the New Testament that says, you know, anybody that has faith in Christ goes immediately to the beatific vision upon death. It's just not there. It's just not in the New Testament. And the admonitions for prayers for the dead so that they can enjoy the pleasures, I mean, of heaven and the glory of God are there. St. Paul, in his correspondence with Timothy, asks, prays for the repose of the soul of his friend Onesiphorus so that he can find favor on that day, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. In light of this Reformed teaching that you just automatically go to heaven immediately when you die.
Appreciate your email there. Matt in Boston, thanks for listening to Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Here's one now from Emmanuel. In the Transfiguration, Dr. Anders, how did the disciples know who Jesus was talking to?
I think the only way to answer that question is that it was made immediately apparent to them by the Spirit of God.
Hmm.
I think they had to have had a kind of an immediate intuition, and kind of an illumination of the Spirit to make that evident to them, or maybe Elijah was standing on top of a flaming chariot and Moses had two big like stone pillars in each hand, you know.
Gee,
I don't know. Maybe there's some sort of iconographical tell right there. But barring that, I think we'd have to just assume it was a kind of supernatural intuition.
Appreciate your email there, and thank you for it, Emmanuel. Here's one now from John. Dr. Anders, for those who say you have to be saved while still on earth to go to heaven, would this be men deciding for themselves who can be saved? Scripture is always quoted by those holding this belief, but ultimately, is it not Jesus who will be the final judge?
I think that what's at stake here is as much the definition of saved as it is the question of who has authority to determine who's saved, right? Mm. So a lot of times when your Protestant friends say, well, have you been saved? What they mean is, have you had a conversion experience, the fruit of which is absolute knowledge, infallible knowledge that when you die, you'll go to heaven? And that's what they mean by the term, right? And so, you know, whereas what a Catholic talks about, have you been saved? Really, you're saved when you are preserved from death and hellfire and torment. Like you're not really saved until you've made it to heaven. You know, you're on the path of salvation, but salvation isn't assured until you get there. So it's a question about what the word means in part.
Okay. Appreciate that. And John, thanks for your email. It's a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Jane in St. Augustine, Florida sends this one. Oh, I guess it would be St. Augustine, wouldn't it? We'll be pagans and call it St. Augustine.
Okay, then.
In Florida. All right. She says, reading St. Luke's Gospel, I was puzzled by Luke 9:27 when Jesus says, quote, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God. What does this mean?
That's, as you might not be surprised to learn, that is a controversial question in Catholic exegesis. But when the passage, I haven't got the Luke text right in front of me, but Mark, on whom Luke bases his account, when St. Mark says it, the next thing that happens is the account of the Transfiguration. And so it's possible that this foretaste of the kingdom of which Jesus is speaking is actually fulfilled in the account of the Transfiguration.
Okay. Appreciate that. And Jane, thanks for listening to us in St. Augustine, Florida. Here's one now from AC in New York, who says, hi, Dr. Anders. When Jesus descended into hell, did he deliver the righteous souls from the abode of the dead immediately after preaching the good news or upon his ascension into heaven? As always, many thanks for all that you and Tom do. Sincerely, AC in New York.
Yeah, thanks. That would be at the ascension.
Okay. Very good. And thank you so much for your email. It's called Communion here on EWTN. This one from Joey in Steubenville, Ohio. Dear Call to Communion, why does Jesus still have wounds after his resurrection, as Jesus showed them his, quote, hands and feet in Luke 24:40 and hands and side in John 20:27? Do you think Jesus will be wounded in eternity as a reminder of his sacrifice? And again, that's Joey in Steubenville.
This is a speculative answer, so this is just my personal opinion.
Okay.
I sort of think this is Jesus' equivalent of buying the T-shirt.
Wow.
Right? That he's signaling, right, to the faithful that this was the means of your redemption. I mean, he certainly doesn't suffer any pain from them, or he's not bleeding out of them or anything like that.
Yeah.
And, of course, Christ could have resurrected himself in such a fashion that he did not bear in his body the marks of his death. But I think it has two effects. One is it shows continuity with the physical body that he had on earth. And the other one is it's an eternal reminder that he is the great high priest who's also the victim who makes intercession for the faithful.
AC, thanks for listening to us in New York. We'll close with this one, an anonymous emailer who says, hi, Dr. Anders, what hope is there that a devout atheist will make it to heaven? Does a casual atheist, that is, the person who just doesn't think about these things, have a better chance for salvation?
Right. Your choice of the word devout is very interesting to me.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So it really depends. Like, we know that to go to heaven, what you need is you need to be united with God in charity, love of God and love of neighbor. But your conception of God can be somewhat hazy. And so, you know, there are atheists who reject the God of a superstitious Christianity or a superstitious Islam or a superstitious Judaism, which God Christians also reject, right? You know what I'm saying? So it may very well be that the God in which atheists don't believe happens to be a God in which Catholics also don't believe. And since they don't have a a better model of the divine nature other than some fundamentalist stereotype. Mm-hmm. What they venerate instead could potentially be some sort of absolute commitment to, say, justice and the common good or the love of neighbor, which, you know, who am I to say what God could account as faith? You know, yeah. Like, so you don't say of anybody, I know for sure they're going to go to hell. You don't say that, right? God gives the offer of grace to everyone, and then he is the judge of souls. And so, you know, there are hardened atheists who are bitter and angry and hateful. There are also some who are atheists out of a genuine concern for, maybe misplaced concern, but genuine, heartfelt concern for human welfare and, you know, humanistic values. And I don't think you can judge those two atheists, you know, the same.
Very good. Dr. David Anders, have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tom.
Hope everybody has a great weekend. We do this program Monday through Friday, so we hope to see you again on Monday for the Monday edition of Call to Communion. On behalf of Charles Berry, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Have that great weekend. See you then. God bless.